Hello and welcome to Pardes from Jerusalem, the podcast series from the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies in Jerusalem. I'm Larry Kluger, a Pardes alum. This week, Parshiot Matot Maaseh. This week, Rabbi Meir Schweiger discusses Parshiot Matot Maaseh. Rabbi Meir Schweiger is a senior faculty member at Pardes and serves as the Pardes Mashkiach Ruchani, the spiritual guide for Pardes. And now, Rabbi Meir Schweiger.
Thank you, Larry. This week we have a double portion, Parshiot, Matot, and Maaseh. I would like to examine something which comes up at the very end of Parshat Maaseh, a point which in fact concludes an issue that is raised in last week's Parsha, and that is the story of the daughters of Tzlofchad. So let us begin with last week's Parsha, chapter 27, verse 1. And the daughters of Tzlofchad, the son of Hefer, the son of Gilad, the son of Machir, the son of Manasseh, of the families of Manasseh, the son of Yosef, came near. And these are the names of the daughters, Machla, Noah, Chogla, Milcah, and Tirzah. This verse sets the background for the whole story, the heading. Let us examine each element in this verse. Perhaps let me begin with the end. The end tells me these are the names of the daughters and goes on to list each one's name. On other occasions, we have spoken about the significance of a name, the significance of being named. A name describes one's essence. Having a name is an expression of significance. If the Torah names these women, the Torah, in effect, is telling me these are significant people. Each one has a name. Each one is an individual. Each one stands out in her own right. It is very interesting that in our Parsha, Parshat Maaseh, in chapter 36, verse 11, when we are told of the daughters getting married to members of their tribe, the order is changed. Noah and Tirzah are reversed. Noah, who is in the beginning in Parsha Pinchas, is replaced by Tirzah in our Parsha. And the rabbis note this point and say the fact that the order is reversed comes to teach me Shekulan shkulot zo kazo, that each one weighed or was weighty as the other. Each one is an individual, and yet nevertheless, they form the collective. Which brings me to the beginning of the verse. Whenever we speak of these women, we always speak of them as a collective. Benot Tzlofchad, the daughters of Tzlofchad. And in all of the discussion surrounding them, they always work together as a unit. This becomes a very, very significant model of people who are individuals in their own right and yet don't allow their ego to prevent them from coming together to work as a collective, which then leads us into the next part of the verse. When these women are presented, we are given their pedigree. They are the daughters of Tzlofchad, the son of Hefer, the son of Gilad, the son of Machir, the son of Manasseh. Why tell me all the different generations? Why conclude with saying, of the families of Manasseh, the son of Joseph? Clearly a key word which comes up in this section is son. Son of son of son of son. And clearly that is the issue which is at stake over here. It is clear that there is a certain continuity which is handed down from father to son, beginning with Joseph. Joseph to Manasseh, to Machir, to Gilad, to Hefer. But all of a sudden there is no longer another son. And here are the daughters who are now coming in, who would like to see that continuity perpetuated. Another point to note, it speaks about the families of Manasseh, the son of Joseph. If you look back at chapter 26 in Parshat Pinchas, there is a census which is taken, a census of the generation which is about to enter the land of Israel. And once again, on other occasions, we have discussed that the book of Bamidbar is known in English as the book of Numbers. And the reason for that is because of the censuses, a census which appears at the beginning of the book, of the generation which left Egypt, and a census which appears in chapter 26, of the generation which is about to enter the land of Israel. A significant difference between the censuses is that the original census focuses on the individual. It highlights kol zachar, each male was counted, to the point where Nachmanides says that every single individual came before Moses and Aaron and presented himself and said, I am so-and-so from such a family. And that's how they were counted. But in chapter 26, rather than the emphasis being placed on the individual, the emphasis is placed on the family. The census is conducted according to the number of families. And it would seem to be that that creates a segue to what comes up at the end of chapter 26, which speaks about the division of the land. The division of the land, which will be divided according to the families. Note the fact that Menasheh was very unusual, in that Menasheh had a number of family branches. It was not only the sons of Menasheh who formed branches, but the grandson, the great-grandson. Each one formed a separate, independent branch within the larger family. So that it is very interesting that the beginning of the verse sets the stage for what I mentioned at the outset of what characterizes the daughters of Tzlofchad. On the one hand, it seems that Menasheh produced a line of individuals who were significant, who created their own family branches, significant family branches, Machir, Gilad, and yet nevertheless, all those individual significant branches are subsumed under the collective of Menasheh, the son of Yosef, so that the daughters of Tzlofchad are following this family tradition of individuals who are very, very significant, but who see themselves as being part of a larger collective. As we will see in a moment, what is motivating the daughters of Tzlofchad is the question of continuity. They would like to see the line of Menasheh, which goes down through Tzlofchad, to not come to an end with Tzlofchad, but to be perpetuated through them. And the way that will be perpetuated is by being given a portion of the land. What is motivating the daughters of Tzlofchad is the idea of being part of something which is much greater than them. As significant as they are individually, as significant as they may feel collectively, as the daughters of Tzlofchad, they are looking for something much greater. To perpetuate the line of Menasheh by being given a portion in the land of Israel. In effect, to become part of that census who will eventually take possession of the land. Let us continue. Chapter 27, verse 2. And they stood before Moshe, before Eleazar the Kohen, before the priests, before the princes, excuse me, and before all of the congregation at the tent of meeting, saying, it is very interesting that they see fit to make their request / demand in a very public manner. It does not say that they go to Moshe privately, but it makes a point, and I would say that perhaps it's emphasizing that this was something done consciously to look for the opportunity to now come before Moshe, before the leadership, not only Moshe, Eleazar the priest, all of the princes, all of the community, at the tent of meeting, which is the rallying place, so that what they will do is in full public view. I would like to note a very interesting parallel, which takes us back to the end of Parshat Balak, where we also have something which is done publicly. And that is in chapter 25, verse 6. And there was a man from the children of Israel who came, who brought near to his brothers a Midianite woman before the eyes of Moshe and before the eyes of the whole congregation. And they were crying at the entrance to the tent of meeting. And we know from the beginning of Parshat Pinchas that this man was Zimri ben Salu, the prince of the tribe of Shimon. And the woman was Kozbi Vatsur, a princess from the house of Midian. And when they come near, they are engaged in an illicit sexual relationship, a sexual relationship which also seems to be somehow interconnected with idolatry. What is the point that I want to make? We have two stories of people who are now making a demonstrative act, who come before Moshe and the whole congregation in order to have a public spectacle, quote unquote. But there is a dramatic difference. Zimri does not come before Moshe. Zimri brings Kozbi, the Midianite woman, near. He brings her near, in full visibility of everyone, before the tent of meeting. But this is being done as a provocative act, as an act of defiance, of rebellion. And we know the end of the story. These two people are killed by Pinchas. Their action leads to a tremendous rupture in the Jewish people. A plague breaks out. 24,000 people die. That is one type of public spectacle. But what is happening with the daughters of Tzlofchad is radically different. The daughters of Tzlofchad are not provocative. And perhaps we can see this already in the verse that I read, chapter 27, verse 2. And they stand before Moshe. When you stand before someone, that's an acknowledgement of their presence. That can be an acknowledgement of submission, of recognition that I am subordinate to you. We find numerous examples throughout Tanakh when instead of using the expression standing before someone, it speaks about standing upon someone, al. As one example, this is what comes up in the Golden Calf. There is an unruly mob which gathers upon Aaron, who dictates to Aaron, get up, make us a golden calf. The daughters of Tzlofchad are not trying to dictate anything. The daughters of Tzlofchad are raising a question, raising an issue. Raising an issue with the proper authorities, by the way they present it, expressing that they are prepared to accept whatever decision will be given. They submit themselves to the authority of Moshe and God. The rabbis comment that the daughters of Tzlofchad were righteous. And although they base it on another verse, which we will see later on, I think you can already see it in this verse, in how they present themselves, how they carry themselves, in the way that they talk to Moshe. It is done with the utmost respect. And now let us look at the content of what they say. Verse 3. Our father died in the desert. He was not among the congregation that gathered themselves in the congregation against God in the congregation of Korach. He died in his own sin. He had no sons. And verse 4. Why should the name of our father be diminished, be eradicated from the midst of his family because he has no son? Give us a possession in the midst of the brothers of our father. Their words are very, very eloquent. There is even a rabbinic comment which appears in the Midrash, which says that each of the daughters made a different point. One daughter says, our father died in the desert. A second one says, he was not in the midst of the congregation that gathered in the congregation of Korach. A third, he died for his own sin. A fourth, he had no sons. A fifth, why should the name of our father be eliminated? They present a case which is very, very convincing. A case for taking possession of the land, which from beginning to end is not about them. It begins with saying, our father died in the desert. Our father should have taken possession of the land, and we are now coming in his stead. They conclude, give us our possession in the midst of our father's brothers. They begin with their father, they conclude with their father. From beginning to end, it's not about them. It's not that we want it. We are coming as the representatives of our father. We are coming as the representatives of our father among his brothers. When his brothers will divide the land, when their children will divide the land, their sons will divide the land, we want our father to be there. We want his line to continue. In sharp contrast with Zimri, whose only principle is self-gratification, here we have polar opposites. The rabbis say the daughters of Tzlofchad, Chachmaniotayu, Darshaniotayu, they were wise. They knew how to expound. They knew what strings to pull, to play on. When they say he was not in the midst of the congregation that gathered upon God, they acknowledge that had he been involved in Korach's rebellion, he could very well have forfeited his claim to a portion in the land of Israel. The rabbis also note, when they say, Kivchet Omet, he died for his own sin. He did not die because he led others to sin. When they say, Ubanim lo hayulo, he had no sons. They are saying, had he had sons, we would not be raising this issue. It is very interesting. Perhaps this is the first example in the Chumash of what we would call today feminism. But Benot Tzlofchad are not demanding, why do the boys get the land and we don't get land? It's not fair. The land should be equally divided between the men and the women. That's not their argument. They're willing to accept that the land should be divided among the men. But their argument is, where there are no men, why can't the women now play that role? If the men are the ones who create that sense of continuity of the line, but if there aren't sons, so why can't the women continue the line? From beginning to end, it is clear in their words that there is no vested interest, no ulterior motive. And that point is crystallized in verse 4 when they say, why should our father's name be eradicated, eliminated from among his family? In a certain way, this might be the ultimate expression of honoring one's parents, to want to perpetuate their name. And not only their name, but their name which is part of a family line. It is very interesting that when the rabbis say the daughters of Tzlofchad were wise, they put in their mouths an argument taken from the laws of Yibum, levirate marriage. Later on in Deuteronomy, we're told that if a man dies and has no children, then his brother is to marry the widow in order to establish the name of the deceased. And the rabbis pick up on this usage of the idea of the name. By Yibum, you're to establish the name of the deceased brother. But over here, the daughters of Tzlofchad say, we don't want our father's name being eliminated, done away with. And so the daughters of Tzlofchad say, but wait a second. Isn't the law by Yibum that if there is a daughter, you do not have a levirate marriage? So what does that show me? That evidently a daughter is also considered to be a child, quote unquote, a child who upholds the name. If that's true, so then over here also, let the daughter be in lieu of a son, and uphold the name by getting a portion of the land. But if you tell me that over here it must be sons, then the same should be true in the case of Yibum. And then according to the Talmud, the daughter said, so then let our mother marry our father's brother, so they will be able to have a son to continue the line. The argument presented by the daughters of Tzlofchad is very eloquently articulated, touches all bases. And maybe to just end with this point, at the end of verse 4, they say, Tzna lanu achuzah, give us possession of the land. They don't just beat around the bush and try to hint at what they want, but after presenting the background, they make very clear what the bottom line is. They want to be given a portion of the land. And then we're told in verse 5, and Moshe brings their case before God. And in the Torah, Mishpatan, with the nun at the end, is written with a long nun as a way of highlighting that Moshe is not just interested in the law, but in the law in this particular case. Or perhaps one could add, is interested in the law being articulated through the agency of these women. Note that Moshe brings their case, Lifnei Hashem, before God. It's as if we have this chain. They stand before Moshe. Moshe then comes before God. And the response of God in verse 7 is, Cain, yes, the daughters of Tzlofchad speak. Or another way of translating this, the daughters of Tzlofchad speak correctly. What they say is absolutely right. Naton titon, you will surely give them a possession of land in the midst of their father's brothers, and you will hand over to them the possession of their father. On the one hand, this is the answer which is appropriate to the question of the daughters of Tzlofchad. It is the answer to their mishpatan, to their particular issue. But then what you find is there's a second point which God says, which is now they have a general law which they have become the precedent for. And although the rabbis say that Moshe knew these laws beforehand, but these laws were not transmitted to the people yet, it is through the agency of the daughters of Tzlofchad that Moshe not only brings them an answer to their particular request, but that they now become the precedent of Jewish law forever. And hence we are told in verse 8, and to the children of Israel you shall say, if a man shall die and has no son, you shall give over his inheritance to his daughter. If there is no daughter, you shall give it to his brothers. If there are no brothers, you shall give it to the brothers of his fathers. I will not go into the laws of inheritance, but suffice it to say, God validates the daughters of Tzlofchad. And I would like to say that it is not only because of the content of their request that they were correct of the legitimacy of having a daughter inherit the land as well as a son, but it was also by virtue of how they presented their case. The how was very important. And now if I fast forward to our parsha, chapter 36, and note the parallel to Parsha Pinchas, chapter 36, verse 1. And the heads of the fathers of the family of the sons of Gilad, the son of Machir, the son of Manasseh, from the families of the sons of Joseph, came near. And they spoke before Moshe, before the princes, before the heads of the tribe of the Jewish people. Notice the parallel, what's happening here. The heads of the fathers of the family come near, just as the daughters of Tzlofchad come near. They speak before Moshe in a similar way to the daughters of Tzlofchad, and not only before Moshe, but before all the leadership. The only difference being that it seems they are not speaking before the whole congregation of Israel. They are not before the tent of meeting. And then they also articulate their position in verse 2. And they say, our master was commanded by God, to give the land as an inheritance to the children of Israel. And our master was commanded by God to give the portion of Tzlofchad, our brother, to his daughters. Once again, note the fact, this is not coming as a challenge, as a rebellion. They are acknowledging Moshe as their master. They say this twice. Not only is he their master, but he is the one who faithfully is transmitting to them the commandment of God. And note that they say, you are the one who has transmitted to us the laws of taking possession of the land. And you were also the one who, in that context, told us that the portion of Tzlofchad, our brother, will be given to his daughters. They too acknowledge the familial relationship. Tzlofchad is their brother. And whatever they're saying is not out of malice, is not being done provocatively, is not being done in a self-serving way, but ultimately is also thinking about Tzlofchad, their brother. And then they come to the request. Verse 3. And if these daughters of Tzlofchad will become wives to someone from a different tribe of Israel, then their inheritance will be eliminated from the inheritance of their fathers, and will be added to the inheritance of the tribe that they will become part of, and the portion of our inheritance will be diminished. And when the Jubilee year will come, verse 4, their inheritance will be added to the inheritance of the tribe that they will become part of, and the inheritance of our fathers will be diminished, or their inheritance will be diminished from the inheritance of our fathers. So now we have a counterclaim. And the counterclaim does not cast aspersions on Moshe, does not cast aspersions on the daughters of Tzlofchad, but is simply now taking what the daughters of Tzlofchad raised one more step. If in fact what is important is the continuity of their father's line, who's part of the tribe, what will happen when they get married? If they get married to someone from another tribe, then that continuity will cease because they will become assimilated into the other tribe. Their father's name as being part of the line of Menashe will come to an end, so that the possession of land that perpetuates the name of their father as being part of the tribe of Menashe will no longer be, because that land will belong to another tribe. And now look at what we have in verse 5. And Moshe commanded the Jewish people by the word of God, saying, yes, the tribe of the sons of Joseph, speak. Or as we said earlier, the same expression, Kain Dovrim, they speak in truth. They speak correctly. This is verse 6. This is what God has commanded the daughters of Tzlofchad, saying, to whoever is good in their eyes, let them become wives, but let them become wives to someone from the family of their tribe, so that an inheritance shall not go around from tribe to tribe, so that everyone will cling to the inheritance of the tribe of their fathers. And then once again, in verse 8, this is now extended beyond the daughters of Tzlofchad. And any daughter who inherits a possession of the land from the tribes of Israel should get married to someone from the families of the tribe of her father, in order that the Jewish people will inherit, each one, the inheritance of his fathers. Note the parallel between the heads of the tribes and of the daughters of Tzlofchad, the way they approach Moshe, the answer which they are given. Both of them are correct. In effect, what is the response? Let the daughters of Tzlofchad get married to whoever they want, but within the tribe. And that way they will preserve the inheritance in the tribe. That way they will see to it that their father's name is perpetuated within the tribe. It is very interesting that the rabbis in the Talmud see this number one, as only being relevant to that generation that initially divided the land of Israel into its constituent parts. But in fact, future generations did not have this directive of having the women marry within the tribe. Secondly, the rabbis did not actually see this as a directive, as an absolute commandment. The rabbis saw this as a suggestion, or what the Gemara says, etza tova, good counsel, advisory. In fact, the daughters of Tzlofchad were not commanded to marry someone within the tribe. They were told that this would be a good idea. And one can even see this in the words, by the fact that it begins in verse 6 by saying, let them become wives to whoever is good in their eyes. Which means that in effect what God is saying is, the most important thing is, let them marry somebody who is really appropriate. With the caveat, but it would be a good idea if they got married to somebody from the family. And perhaps to just conclude this particular part, verse 10, as God commanded Moses, so did the daughters of Tzlofchad do. And the verse which I mentioned earlier, where it gives me the names of the different women, in verse 11, and Machla Tirzah Chogla Milka Noah, the daughters of Tzlofchad, married their cousins. Verse 12, from the families of Menasheh, the son of Joseph, did they become wives. And their possession of land, their inheritance, remained within the tribe of the family of their father. What an appropriate conclusion. The daughters of Tzlofchad in the end, from beginning to end, thought of upholding the name of their father, thought of the continuity of the tribe, took a stand, a public stand, went out on a limb, something which was very, very unusual, but for a much greater cause. Took a stand not in a way which was confrontative, which was divisive, but in the end was to bring about a greater good. And in fact, through their agency, there were this new legislation which is given over to the Jewish people. I would like to conclude with a point which is not explicit in the text, but which the rabbis see implicitly in this story. Beyond the question of being loyal to their father, to their family, to their tribe, of being very much concerned with the issue of continuity, the rabbis also see that was what was motivating them was a tremendous love of the land of Israel. And the rabbis note a very interesting contrast. The daughters of Tzlofchad and Parshat Pinchas say, give us our possession. The Jewish men, after the spies came back, said, Nitna Rosh v'nashuva Mitzrayma, let us give us a head so that we can return to Egypt. And on that basis, the rabbis say, Yafeh koach nashim mikoach anashim. More beautiful, greater, is the power of the women than the power of the men. And it's very interesting, the language, the power. Perhaps let me phrase it slightly differently. Power here in the sense of taking a stand. Taking a stand for something that you believe in. Believe in very, very passionately. The women here took a stand. And according to the rabbis, that stand was motivated by a tremendous love of the land of Israel. The men took a stand, but a stand that was a rejection of the land of Israel. In our parsha, we have another story of two tribes, Gad and Reuven, who want to take possession of the land, or take their possession, on the eastern side of the Jordan, because it is grazing land, and because they have lots of sheep. And Moshe becomes very upset with them, and says to them, will your brethren go to battle, and you will sit here? And eventually they reach an understanding, where yes, they will take possession of the land on the eastern side of the Jordan, but before they can take possession of it, they must accompany the Jewish people, fight their battles, and only once everyone else has taken possession of their land can they go back and settle on the eastern side. And after all the negotiations that happen in chapter 32 in our parsha, at the very end, all of a sudden we're told of half of the tribe of Manasseh that is also going to be part of that group that's taking possession on the eastern side of the Jordan. And it kind of begs the question, but the people who were raising the issue were Gad and Reuven. Where does Manasseh come from? Why half of Manasseh? And there's a rabbinic comment which says that the tribe of Manasseh, as the daughters of Tzlofchad, loved the land of Israel. And they purposely split up in order to be able to show that the western side of the Jordan and the eastern side of the Jordan are all part of Israel. We are one people. This is one land. And in fact, if you look at the end of chapter 32, you'll see that Reuven and Gad simply came in and built cities and took possession of their land. Manasseh had to fight battles, had to dispossess the local population before they could take possession. They didn't just come and take something that was handed to them on a silver platter, but perhaps they also set a certain model that if you want to be able to get something, you have to fight for it. No pain, no gain. So I would like to conclude by saying, we are now in the midst of the 3 weeks. The 3 weeks which mark a period of mourning for the destruction of the temple. But it is not only the destruction of the temple, it is also the loss of Jewish sovereignty. And one could also say, it is also a period of mourning for perhaps the lack of appreciation of what the land of Israel means to us, of what our inheritance is. The daughters of Tzlofchad, the tribe of Manasseh, can perhaps become a model for us of people who are not motivated because of green pastures, of people who are not motivated because of self-indulgence like Zimri, self-gratification, but of people who have a much wider perspective, who see themselves as part of a continuity, who see the land as the crystallization of that continuity. Nachala comes from the root nachal, which means to flow, the word for a stream. Nachala flows. It is handed down from the previous generation and is supposed to go to the next generation. This is the orientation of the daughters of Tzlofchad, to see themselves as part of that flow, to always ask themselves, what can we do to promote that? To take a stand where that stand will ultimately create a better sense of continuity for the Jewish people. Shabbat Shalom.
Thank you, Rabbi Schweiger. Your comments on the podcast are always appreciated, so please send your emails to podcasts@pardesusa.org. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll see you on the next episode of Pardes from Jerusalem.